All right, well, good morning. So Dave is up here talking about anger from the book of James, and Terry's over there elbowing me the whole time. We should have just skipped that whole passage and just went on, left it out. Oh, did we miss that? All right, so many, I'm losing my voice already, haven't got started. Many, many years ago, we used to meet on Pearl Street, and at lunch, sometimes I would just walk a few blocks away to one of many fast food restaurants. And one particular afternoon, I was headed to Arby's, and there was a guy standing on the street corner and on the sidewalk in front of the liquor store down there, and he wanted something like $10 for lunch or something. And I said, "Hey, I'm on my way to Arby's. Why don't you join me and I'll buy you lunch?" He says, "Oh man, I can't go to Arby's. My ex-girlfriend works there and it'd be real awkward." He says, "Okay, well, Taco Bell is just across the street. We'll go there." He says, "Oh no, man. I used to work there at Taco Bell, and the boss and I didn't get along, and I can't go there." I says, "Well, then there's this rally." He says, "Hey man, you gonna give me the money or not?" So that image often comes to mind when talking about this subject that we're on here. Today is part four. I've titled it Generosity, Compassion, and Wisdom. And after talking to a couple of our folks this week, I wanted to just begin with a brief clarification here. The purpose of this series is not to provide answers for every scenario. As we've already seen, there are many different kinds of poverty, many different causes for poverty, and we don't treat every situation the same. The main cause, of course, the cause behind all the various causes is the fall. The ultimate cure for poverty then will be the new heavens and the new earth. And so during this present age, when humanity continues to suffer the effects of the curse, we will constantly find ourselves struggling with trying to find the right approach, the right program, the right method, and they will all in one way or another come up short. It's just the way it is. The purpose of this short series, therefore, is not that of claiming here's the right way, we all need to do it like this, but to simply challenge us to think through how we approach all of this, think through it more carefully. And, we need to be charitable and generous, large-hearted and eager to help. And in that generosity, we need to be wise and discerning, careful not to do more harm than good. Had I given that guy $10 without offering to buy him meal and working him through that process, we're standing in front of the liquor store. Can you put two and two together? It would have done more harm than good. So some of these principles I've been talking about are designed for that one-on-one request you might face on the street corner or at your front door or from a relative. Others are better suited for how to handle charitable organizations that ask for support. And some are directed toward churches who wish to help alleviate suffering in their local communities. And some of the principles we've been covering would apply across the board, like don't do for others what they can do for themselves. So a quick review to set things up for today. On the first two Sundays of this series, we looked at a number of scriptures that call on believers to help those who are in need, to imitate God's love, a love that is large-hearted and generous. And all of us here, as we have talked about, are rich in the present world, and so this weighty charge to the rich that we find here in Paul's letter to Timothy is one that would apply to each of us. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. And to borrow from C.S. Lewis, there ought to be things we would like to do and cannot do because our gifts to charity prevents us from doing that. So again, 2 weeks on drilling us to be selfless and sacrificial, and this is really foundational because everything else is built on that. And then on the third Sunday, we consider the problems of blind generosity. The Lord expects us to use discernment. In fact, there are times when just giving money could actually do more harm than good. People are poor for a variety of different reasons, and the answer to helping them starts with addressing the reasons they are poor in the first place. And as you will remember, we listed out 9 common causes of poverty, offered suggestions on how to address each one. We're not going to take time now to review those. But with a list like this, one can stop and assess whether the request is actually legitimate or not, and when it is legitimate, determine the best way to help. Again, money might not always be the best way. And I propose that when we're talking about legitimate needs, generally speaking, we can limit it to really basically the following: some of the mentally and physically disabled, some of the elderly, some widows, some orphans, some victims of natural disaster, some mothers with young children whose husbands have deserted them, some who suffer from medical conditions that result in huge expenses, loss of employment, some who live in economically depressed areas of the world where employment is scarce, some refugees and victims of war-torn areas, and those who suffer from other unexpected hardships. And for instance, we might think of the famine in Jerusalem mentioned in the New Testament and how the churches in Macedonia reached out to help them. So some on this list need immediate yet temporary help. Others require something more long-term. In our society, especially here in America, a number of these people would qualify for some sort of government assistance. There are just numerous programs, as we know, and some, depending on the situation, will also be covered by insurance and or have relatives who would step in. But even with such assistance, what is provided can sometimes be inadequate, and these then would become opportunities for us. However, even in these situations, wisdom and discernment is still called for. How exactly will we help them, and for how long? How will it be administered? What are our long-term goals and objectives, and how can we help them without causing them to become overly dependent on us or on others and lose their self-respect? Is there a way to help them without compromising their mission before God as stewards of his creation? And, these require a lot of work, and they can be tough questions. So the plan for today, I should have a blank slide there. All right. The plan for today is to continue with all this and to build on what we have covered so far. So with that in mind, let me start off with another true story. Let me just get back. Many years ago, before the story I just gave, this is before that, this would be back in the mid-90s, I was employed at a local computer store where I sold and repaired computers, and in some situations installed them in businesses and even in homes. And I had one customer named David who was in his early 30s, and David was completely bedridden, totally paralyzed from the neck down. And as I remember it, this was the result of some sort of diving accident from misjudging the depth of the water, virtually identical to the situation with Johnny Erickson Tata. Same type of accident, same type of injury. And I was sent to his home to install a computer, set up a dictation device and software, and teach him how to use it. And this is back in the mid-90s, so technology is nowhere near what it is today. Dictation tools available at the time were pretty crude, unreliable, clumsy to use, still required some use of the keyboard and that sort of thing. And so this was going to involve a lot of work on his part. And the whole time I'm wondering, is this really going to be worth it to him? And when I was setting everything up, I had, of course, had to ask. So Dave, I'm curious, what will you be using the computer for? And I assumed it had something to do with entertainment, computer games, that sort of thing. It wouldn't be, of course, for Facebook, social media, streaming movies, because none of that had been on, had come on the scene yet. But the answer that he gave was not anything that I was expecting. He had a business degree, knew how to create and manage spreadsheets, and was planning to help out with one of the local charities with their finances and bookkeeping. I mean, I was not expecting that. Here was a man who had to be served by others, completely paralyzed from the neck down, had no use of his hands whatsoever, but yet found an opportunity to serve and was determined to do so, regardless of all the work that was going to be involved. He was going to live a productive life, bedridden as it was. So, I would go back about once a month to follow his progress and help out as needed, and I was always taken back by the amount of effort that he exerted. To use that computer with that awkward dictation device and awkward software, he just pressed on. So I think sometimes, maybe really a lot of times, we are too quick to assume that someone who has needs, even legitimate needs, are utterly helpless on their own. And this, of course, is a common assumption that we all make. But we need to be careful with this, because sometimes we need to just stop for a moment and really consider the bigger picture. Just because someone needs help doesn't mean that they are utterly helpless. And when we treat them like they are utterly helpless or accommodate any attitude that they might have about that, we can end up injuring the person's sense of self-worth. After all, the ultimate goal is not to simply provide them with groceries and heat for their homes, but to help them function as human beings made in the image of God. And here, you know, I'm not talking about situations that require immediate and temporary relief, like victims of earthquakes and hurricanes, but situations where the need is ongoing or the request is. David could not take care of himself. There was nothing he could do about that. He was always going to depend on others, but yet he was determined to contribute to the betterment of society nonetheless. He was not utterly helpless after all, and he did not want to be treated as though he was. And if he, think about this, with such an extreme disability, such an extreme disadvantage, could do something useful, then there is no reason to not expect others to be useful whose disadvantage is far less severe. God ordained work so that humans can worship him through their work. And by work, I'm not necessarily referring to that which earns an income, it would include that, but labor itself, doing something that is productive. That's how we, you know, we're made in his image. We are producers. God has wired us to find fulfillment in this way. We enjoy a sense of satisfaction that contributes to a healthy self-esteem. We feel better about ourselves when we accomplish things, doing things that are constructive, that others benefit from. If we enable people to live unproductive lives by just doing everything for them, then we end up working against God's very design, his intended purposes. You know, think about that when you have, you know, adult sons and daughters who are always wanting money for this and this and that, you know. Can't you do something for yourself once in a while? And this now brings us to another big issue. It's kind of a delicate issue, and it's going to be one that as I get through this, you're going to probably think that doesn't apply to me, but I want you to just think about it as though it could very well apply to you. Sometimes we not only hurt those who are trying to help, but we also hurt ourselves. Without even thinking about it, we end up feeding certain unhealthy motives going on in us. And this, in the long run, will harm us both emotionally and spiritually. When it comes to helping others, it is not uncommon to be motivated by more than just a sense of compassion and mercy. There can also be some degree of paternalism going on as well. And it's actually a pretty common thing for middle and upper class Christians, especially here in America. Paternalism comes in a variety of forms, but basically it is this need to be needed. We feel some level of satisfaction in having someone or someones dependent upon us. And there's often some ego thing going on as well, enjoying the fact that we are in a position to do that. Again, remember the words of Paul to Timothy, command those who are rich in this present world to not be arrogant. That's how he starts off. Wealth and arrogance seem to go together. There is a subtle idea that one's lack of poverty means that, you know, they therefore have it all together. You know, I'm not like those who have failed in life, who were irresponsible and didn't amount to much. But fortunate for them, I'm here to help. Our culture has conditioned us to think that social status and wealth serve as a measurement of one's importance, worth, and significance. James, of course, warns about all this in the second chapter of his letter. You know, this attitude that I'm better than the guy who comes in wearing shabby clothes. And the sense of superiority can create a lot of problems when it comes to helping the poor. Paternalism is this need people have to mother the needy, of looking down from one's superior position and thinking, oh, you poor thing, let me help you with that. Let me do that for you. And then thinking, what would they do without me? If only others would follow my example. America seems to have this attitude with developing nations. Church denominations and churches can have this attitude when sending workers into the foreign lands. And so can individual Christians with a friend or a relative or neighbor, whatever. In all of this, we feed our own elitism and belittle the very people we're trying to help. Now, I'm not saying that all who are eager to be generous are motivated by this, but it is nonetheless something we just all need to be mindful of, careful with, because no one's exempt from adopting this kind of attitude. Whenever you find some sense of satisfaction from knowing that someone needs you, well, that's a big red flag. This itself is a type of poverty, a spiritual one, a spiritual deficit, one that's worse probably than lacking material wealth. It's a deficit of humility, a deficit of seeing oneself as equal to others. It's now about meeting some need in oneself rather than meeting the need of the other person. So, just because we have a higher standard of living does not mean that we are better or more important or are more deserving of God's blessings or are God's answer to the world or the answer to poverty itself. And this mindset that one who has little, who can only afford to wear shabby clothes is a loser, and that I, who have made something of my life and better, is the very mindset that the Corinthians were harshly condemned and rebuked for in chapter 11 that we talked about last week. And so this paternal thing is when we do for others what they should be doing for themselves, not only contributes to their unhealthy dependence on us and others, but can also contribute to our own arrogance and spirit of elitism. So, assuming that the needs are legitimate and assuming that our motives are clean, let's now move on to the various ways assistance can be provided. Given that not all poverty is the same, there will, of course, be different ways to help. And this brings us to the big three: relief, rehabilitation, and development. This may sound familiar because we covered some of this like 13 years ago. So there is a need for each approach, but each one is different. And in any given situation, we must make the necessary distinction and act accordingly. We actually got into this a little bit last time when working through those 9 reasons for poverty. So there'll be some overlap here. So let's start with relief. We can simply define this as provision of emergency aid in order to reduce suffering from either a natural or man-made crisis. Outside help is needed. It's needed now. Relief is also going to be a temporary arrangement, or at least it should be. And we might think of it as stop the bleeding. The Good Samaritan, taking care of the helpless man along the roadside, is an excellent example of relief applied appropriately. Giving money over and over to a lazy person who won't work is an example of relief applied inappropriately. Most of the time, what typically comes to mind for most people when addressing poverty is relief, but relief by nature is going to be a short-term fix. So rehabilitation, this is more of a process, involves more than just providing money or tangible help. Here we're trying to improve the person's condition by working with him. In many cases, it's simply restoring him to what he once was or what he once had. Now, we tend to associate rehabilitation with things like counseling and treatment, but the concept is wider than that. It could also involve recovery and restoration. One example could be that of earthquake victims in Haiti, for instance. Working with and alongside outside teams from America and elsewhere and rebuilding their homes and businesses and communities. We might think of Tom and Suja in West Africa. Tom in particular works alongside the indigenous people there, passing on useful information on how to improve their farming techniques and how to become successful entrepreneurs so as to better their standard of living, raising them out of poverty. A number of people once had a difficult time there providing for themselves, have now learned how to make soap, for instance, market it and sell it. And the same with popcorn and wood-burning biscuits and all sorts of things. And you know, he works with others one-on-one to improve their quality of life, but they are the ones doing it. Or in the case of the town drunkard who can't afford a job, who can't hold a job. Rehabilitation in this situation could, for instance, consist of working with him and overcoming his addiction, as in being a sponsor or mentor and helping him obtain necessary job training so that he could become employable. Or in the case of a person who won't work, maybe his laziness is due more to the fact that he is without hope and he's been unsuccessful in previous jobs, has become filled with despair. Efforts of rehabilitation would involve addressing those doubts and false ideas that have crippled him. And evangelism would, of course, be a part of that. The basic idea behind rehabilitation is that of recovery. Something needs to be restored, made right. It could be physical, it could be spiritual. After relief and rehabilitation, there is, however, still that needs to be done. And this brings us to development, and this is a big subject. It too is a process, but it's a much larger one. You might even think of it as a lifelong process that all of us are to be engaged in. Here we are looking to improve society itself, fostering an environment where people can benefit from their labors and do so according to the principles found in the Bible. And in the end, reduce poverty on a wide-scale level. And we may never be able to eliminate it, but we can, you know, attack it and reduce it. Dismantling common lies that lead to poverty would certainly be one example. Excuse me. Development, for instance, would include evangelism in those starving Hindu cultures that venerate the livestock they should be eating. The gospel is also the answer to fatalism, the idea that the universe has destined you to poverty and you are obligated to accept that. Numerous examples, including that of working for laws and government policies that would encourage success and prosperity. By and large, nations that have a history of being influenced by a Judeo-Christian ethic tend to be more prosperous than those who aren't influenced in that way. And the level of poverty tends to be less severe as well. Development also includes some of the efforts of advocacy, working through the courts, the laws, and the public square to expose oppression that results in poverty from institutions, corporations, individuals, even governments that exploit others for financial gain. From a certain perspective, you might say that one of the goals of development is to see everyone earn money, spend money wisely, save money, and give money in a way that honors God in all things. Whatever the case, in the really big picture, the objective is to reduce poverty in all of its various forms, not just material poverty. It's to move everyone, those being helped and those helping, closer to a right relationship with God and with others. It is the task of all of us becoming complete in our humanness, of being what God intended us to be. Think again of the principles we learned from the book Being Human that we all went through many years ago. For instance, as the materially poor develop, they are better able to fulfill their calling of glorifying God by working and supporting themselves and their families with the fruits of that work. And as the materially wealthy develop, they are able to become more humble and dependent upon God, more willing to share, less arrogant, less paternal. Development is an investment we all make in others and in ourselves, and involves the ongoing investment in everything, in individuals, in communities, in the world itself. And that investment involves our time, energy, resources, money, you know, the whole works. And again, the objective is to reduce all forms of it, financial and spiritual. And the gospel, of course, is going to be the key factor in all of this. One thing to keep in mind is that rehabilitation and development are just as legitimate as relief. And that does need to be ingrained in us. For instance, we are conditioned to think that a church is failing its mission if it does not have a food bank or soup kitchen, or collect grocery items from its members once a month and distribute them door to door in rundown neighborhoods, or a program in place to help people pay their utility bills, you know, these sorts of things. But a given church might actually lack the resources and expertise or even volunteers, the manpower to run such programs effectively, and may better be suited to help alleviate poverty that would be more in line with the, you know, with the task of rehabilitation or development. If a relief program cannot be administered well or in the right way, then I would argue it's best not to have it. How many small churches have really the time and resources to properly differentiate between those who are trying to exploit the generous and those who have legitimate needs, and have the expertise and experience to figure out the best way to meet the needs that are legitimate? One option, of course, when it comes to relief, is to support local organizations and churches that do, those who do it well and do it right. Because all of this is just, it's too important to not do it well and do it right. And we need more than just good intentions. And this now brings us to another point. Take the guy in front of the liquor store who approached me for money, or for that matter, someone holding a cardboard sign at one of the stoplights there at Jefferson Point, or someone who calls the church wanting us to pay their water bill. In these situations, in those moments, it is common to call to mind various sayings of Jesus of helping the poor, which is good because that's how it should be. But we also have to realize that the setting back then when Jesus said those things is a whole lot different than what it is today. So follow me here with this. When others heard his exhortation firsthand in that original audience to give to the poor, they saw something altogether different than what we see. What came to mind would be Benjamin, the crippled man at the city gate begging for food every day. Or Abigail, the blind woman who's down at the city well asking for assistance. Names and faces of specific widows and orphans and the truly needy would come to mind. They lived in a community-based society where practically everyone knew each other, and they knew who the scammers were, who the poor were because they were lazy, and who were poor because they wasted money on prostitutes, gambling, and so on. And they knew who among them were poor because they could not care for themselves, who had legitimate needs, and the best way to meet those needs. The words "give to the poor" had a personal connection to them. But that's not the case with us. When we hear those words, we see images from TV commercials or advertisements in Christian magazines or pictures found in mass mailings. The poor is much more abstract to us. Homeless people in the inner city, refugees in some third world country, a village in Central Africa. We know they are there, but they are out there. We don't know them. And so when we are presented with a request, usually out of nowhere from somebody we don't know, well, there is, as you can see, quite a bit more that is involved here. After all, does anyone here have a neighbor or friend or relative or personally know someone who, like the widows mentioned in 1 Timothy that Paul mentions there, prays day and night asking God to provide for their basic needs? I bet we don't. And so the charge here is still there to help, but there are more steps involved. That's what we have to come to grips with. We have to exercise more discernment and make sure that the help is not only legitimate, but is being used in the way we intended. And this means that to a large degree, when it comes to needs under the relief category, it might really be best oftentimes to channel that through a nonprofit charity that specializes in that, one that has the resources, expertise, and experience and manpower to do it well and do it right. So obviously, it goes without saying, if we had a member in our church struggling or a member who knows of a situation somewhere, something where we would have firsthand information on what the need is and whether it's legitimate, well, hopefully we would all respond favorably to something like that. I'm sure we would. But that's different than actually running a relief program. So we have some organizations that are local, many larger ones that operate on a national level. Some specialize in relief, some in both relief and rehabilitation, many in development. And like anything, do your research. None, of course, are perfect. And a good place to start would be what I would suggest these three watchdog groups. There are others, but these are the three of the more common ones. They monitor the income, expenses of the more popular charitable organizations and rate them accordingly. So don't give blindly to every mass mailing that you get. Do some research. Now, they aren't able to include, local ones are smaller, but they do a good job of covering the larger ones that we are all familiar with. MinistryWatch.org is an evangelical organization that focuses on Protestant ministries. The other two, Charity Navigator and Charity Watch, they are secular organizations and they monitor all charities. All three look at the salaries of the top executives, the overhead costs, how much is spent on fundraising, percentage of money that's actually used for the intended purpose, the makeup of the board of directors, transparency, history of infractions, maybe they got in trouble at one point, that kind of stuff. So as an example, Ministry Watch gives Samaritan's Purse, an organization we are all familiar with, a rating of 56 out of 100 with the warning, exercise caution. Charity Navigators gives them 100 out of 100 with the words "give with confidence." And Charity Watch gives them an A-minus, applauding them for meeting a number of different benchmarks. So there's differences here. Now, Ministry Watch has a higher level scrutiny and believes that Samaritan's Purse needs more transparency, that its board members has too many board members that are related to each other. They don't like that. And the organization needs more outside accountability. So those are the things that come into play. So probably the best approach when researching a charity is to compare what each of them say and then use your best judgment. And as you will soon see, not all Christian charities are created equal. A lot of differences. For instance, I don't want to disturb you here, but I found this very disturbing. Some of the leaders of popular Christian charities will make $700,000 to $900,000 a year. And so one has to ask, how much money is actually going to helping those in need, and how much is going to these excessive, exorbitant salaries? All right, finally for today, I want to propose something for your consideration. As mentioned earlier, when we hear the words the poor, we tend to think of homeless people in the streets, refugees in war-torn areas of the world, a small village in Africa, a rundown home in the Appalachians, that sort of thing. But there's another image that I would encourage you to bring to mind as well. Another people group that I would argue are quite poor, and the legitimacy of their needs unquestionable. They literally cannot do anything about their situation. And we have them in our own community. And they are the youngest members of our human race. The most helpless, the most innocent, the most fragile, the most destituted, the most dependent on others, and also the most rejected and the most forgotten among us. And they would, of course, be the unborn babies in the wombs of abortion-minded women. They have absolutely nothing. The only thing that they do have, their lives, is about to be taken from them. And they are utterly helpless to do anything about that. And I would just propose the rhetorical question. Can you think of anyone who better fits the definition of an orphan? It is one thing to not have parents, but what about having parents who have decided to rid themselves of you? Here's an example of extreme poverty because of injustice. And so advocates who could speak out against this oppression are called for, along with efforts to change unjust laws and help society come to grips with the truth, and efforts to help women carrying their babies, like crisis pregnancy centers who work with them through various, who work them through various life-giving options and provide tangible assistance to these moms as needed. There is a need for all three here: relief, rehabilitation, and development. And here we would think, of course, of the works of Michael Spencer and Scott Klusendorf and Christina Francis, Created Equal, Allen County Right to Life, the Women's Care Center, the Hope Center, and many, many more, including those on the front lines like sidewalk counselors and those who go to the abortion clinics to pray. Most people don't really make the connection that, you know, that they are all in the business of alleviating poverty, but they are, and they deserve to be supported, and they deserve to have our involvement. Okay, so next week, we will conclude with a look at short-term mission trips. It is here, short-term mission trips, where all the principles we've been talking about come into play. And I've been on two such trips. Like everything else we have been talking about, we should not assume that every mission trip has value and should be supported, whether it be one's participation or one's finances. There are important questions that need to be asked, because you know, not all short-term mission trips are created equal. And the same is for sending missionaries into the field on a long-term basis, supporting them financially. Some trips are fruitful and God-honoring, but some, even those that are well-intended, do more harm than good. So this is an important subject. Even if you don't ever plan to go on a trip, chances are high that someone will ask you for financial support that does plan to go. And so it might be useful to have a list of questions ready to go when that occurs. All right, so I think we have the musicians come at this time. All right, and let's stand, and we'll close here with a concluding song.